Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the Dionandia podcast. I'm Dr. Raywad Dionandan, epidemiologist and global health researcher. And today I'm going to be streaming an interview I did recently with CKNW Radio in Vancouver on the Sean Leslie Show, which was hosted that day by Squire Barnes. The interview is about the current Ebola outbreak in West Africa, with a couple of cases now in North America. And CKNW has kindly allowed me to reproduce the interview here on my website. So without further ado, here we go.
Squire Barnes sitting in for Sean Leslie, who is getting a weekend off to enjoy Thanksgiving with the family. Well, at the start, the Ebola crisis seemed a long way away. And now in Texas, we have had a man who died after coming over from Africa, and now the nurse, or one of the nurses who was treating him, has contracted Ebola. And that has freaked a lot of people out, and for good reason, because you would think the nurses and the doctors would have layered up the way they were supposed to, and nothing was to get at them, but something has. Raywad Dionandan is a professor at the Interdisciplinary School of Health Sciences at the University of Ottawa, an epidemiologist, a global health researcher. He joins us on the phone. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me.
How surprised are you at this news about the nurse in Dallas contracting Ebola?
I'm surprised, but I think, you know, we have to be careful not to be too scared or panicked prematurely. It sounds to me like it's probably a case of someone not following the appropriate containment protocols. So if that's the case, that's a human error. It's not a system error. So I'm going to reserve my emotional response until more information comes forth.
Now, I have a friend who is a nurse and has been for years, and I talked to her today just to get her ideas on it. And she said, from a distance, it sounds that maybe it wasn't so much did she layer up properly. It was when she was removing what she had worn. That sometimes, if you don't follow that protocol, you can get something that way. Is that correct?
It's possible. I mean, at this point, it's still too early to tell. And I don't think that's going to be the fullness of this story. The story is a global one. It's not about a particular instance of protocol not being followed. And I think we can get distracted if we focus on those elements right now. The bigger picture is, are the appropriate procedures in place? Are the institutions in place? Are there institutions and policies and protocols that are appropriate for making sure that all of us are safe and well protected?
Well, let me ask you that question. Do you feel that everything is in place?
Yes, I do, actually. I think here in the industrialized West, we actually have a fairly strong public health system that is well-enabled to respond to this sort of emergency. We differ quite substantially from the public health infrastructure in the developing countries where this disease originated. And amongst the ways that we differ is we know how to respond quite well and rapidly to infectious disease outbreaks, and we have this thing called surveillance, which is what my article was about that started this conversation. We know pretty well when the first few cases of a particularly virulent infectious agent appear in our population, and we have procedures in place to rapidly respond to those things. So I have confidence that if such an event were to occur in a Canadian population, that the response would be rapid and appropriate.
Such as SARS in Toronto?
Yeah, I mean, SARS was a special case in that we had never heard of that disease before. It was relatively new. Ebola is actually well known. It's been with us for 40 years. It's been well studied. We see it coming down the pipeline. So we're actually much better prepared for Ebola in many ways than we were for SARS. And the further good news is that SARS sort of woke us up. It caused us to create new institutions in this country, among them the Public Health Agency of Canada, and to rethink our containment procedures and how we do surveillance and how we have a rapid response system. So in many ways, SARS was good for us in the sense that it caused us to be better prepared for pandemics down the road.
Now, explain health surveillance.
Sure. It's a scary word because it brings up, you know, allusions to Big Brother, but with the disease surveillance, what we're talking about here is the routine monitoring of a population for the signs of disease, usually a specific disease. And it doesn't have to be a technological procedure. It can be very low-tech, but it works best if it's technological. Essentially, it's the idea that we're on the lookout all the time for the first signs of certain kinds of diseases such that we can respond appropriately and rapidly.
Now, when you say health surveillance, people automatically think, oh, you know, you come through an airport, you get checked when you come off a plane for a disease.
That's not what I'm talking about at all. We have both passive and active surveillance systems in this country. So a passive system is when a disease that appears in what's called the notifiable disease registry is noticed by a clinician, and they are required to report that incidence to a central authority. So we passively collect this information and can respond to it. The active cases is then we go out and look for the instance of disease, much like scanning people at the airport. But the way that surveillance is done in this country, we have literally hundreds of surveillance programs running all the time. We have laboratory reports. We have morbidity reports from healthcare professionals. We have tombstone data from death certificates. We have active surveillance like surveys and things like that. We have absenteeism data from workplaces that give us a sense of where disease is. So we are really alert all the time to a certain set of diseases.
Now, is there any way, Professor, to transfer how we do things to, say, West Africa?
Yes, and I'll draw your attention to the case of Nigeria, which is being celebrated as being one of the shining stars of the Ebola outbreak, if I can use those interesting words. So Nigeria had a case of Ebola during the current outbreak, but they also had an existing, well-defined, and well-designed polio surveillance system that was funded in large part by the Gates Foundation. And Nigeria very cleverly just translated their polio system to respond to Ebola. And what that meant was they had their contact tracing already in place. They had a command center already there. They just mimicked their polio command center and created one for Ebola. They had well-trained epidemiologists already in place. They had to retrain some to be specific to Ebola. And they sent them out in the field and very rapidly, we think, contained their epidemic much more quickly than, say, Liberia or Sierra Leone did. I should point out that these countries are really resource-strapped. We in Canada, we spend about $6,000 per person per year in our healthcare. A West African country would spend much less than $100 per person. And so what little money there is for healthcare is being spent on primary care, on curative disease. It doesn't leave a lot for investing in public health infrastructure. But I'd like to argue that what little there is should be spent in large part on surveillance to avoid these kinds of scenarios.
Now, you said something very interesting at the start when we talked about the case of the nurse in Dallas. And you're right, it's one case, and that's not the issue. The issue is much larger than that. But when it gets close to home, people in North America automatically zero in on that, like how could it happen here type of thing. But you said it's a global issue. I often wonder why don't, and maybe they do, and I'm not aware of this, why don't Western governments say, look, this is something, if something happens in one part of the world, because of the way we can travel in the 21st century, it could easily come over to us. Why don't we try to put the systems here and pay for the systems and help pay for the systems in the countries that wouldn't normally have that so we can contain these at source?
That's a very astute question, Squire. I'm glad you asked it. I think we have to remember three important things about the way we live today that's different from the way our forebears lived 100 years ago. One is that we travel much more today. Two is that we travel much faster today. And three is that many of the diseases that we may encounter in our travels have latency or incubation periods that are longer than the time it takes for us to travel, as we're observing now with Ebola. And those three things together means that there are no boundaries or state borders anymore when it comes to disease, not that there ever were. And as a result, you're absolutely correct. We have to think of pandemic disease as global issues and possibly even security threats. I'll point to a report about 10 years ago from the Pentagon, of all people, that suggested that the biggest threat to American national security in coming decades is actually climate change. And the mechanism by which climate change would threaten American security would be through the production of refugees and the production of changing disease states. And that's very interesting to me. It means that they have recognized that it's not terrorism, it's not rogue nukes, it's actually disease and environment that are relevant to our local security and health and well-being here in North America. So to answer your question, why haven't they been investing? Well, I think that's a failure of imagination. There's been a slow divestment from our responsibilities abroad to look more at business development and maybe security investments more so than public health infrastructure. And I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, you think of, and I think I read this in your article, you think of all the money that is spent on ways to kill people with weapons, and that the money spent on trying to stop a disease like this or other diseases of this kind pales in comparison.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? I cited the cost of a single Predator drone as being about $4 million. I was involved in a public health strengthening project in Guyana that lasted about 5 years and that cost Canadian taxpayers about $5 million. And that remade that country's entire public health response system for the cost of a single Predator drone. And that employed thousands, it probably saved thousands of lives, and it was a good thing. Whereas the weapons we make kill people, employ a handful of individuals, and create ill will around the world. So our priorities are really quite skewed.
Let me ask you a question. A lot of people who don't know much about this, just know the basics, would say, well, a good way to stop the spread of a disease, if it happens to show up somewhere, is just cancel all flights coming out of there, and no one can leave and no one can come in here.
Yeah, I understand that response. It makes a kind of guttural, hindbrain kind of sense. But the truth is that it also prevents us from stopping the disease. Once you stop the flights, we stop the ability to send help and to send investigators. The people going over there to assist in this disease aren't taking military flights. They're taking commercial flights. And we're relying upon the flight network to get the help there. In absence of that, it will be out of control very fast. So the solution is not isolation. The solution is greater engagement. It sounds counterintuitive, but this seems to be the case.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. One last question, and that is the World Health Organization. What is their role now?
That's an interesting question. They've kind of, in the last few decades, retreated from the role of being first responder to these emergencies, and they consider themselves more to be technical advisors. So they would, collate the data, the surveillance data from around the world. They would be a central authority or repository for response protocols, and maybe be an organizing body for the training of individuals. But beyond that, it's really, in my opinion, fallen to the larger, more vocal NGOs like Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and the CDC in the U.S. to be the leaders in this field.
Should they not be the spearhead, though?
I believe so. I believe that that should be their role. And this is something that will require a lot of introspection and administrative navel-gazing in coming years as we reassess how this response was taken care of.
Yeah, you would think there should be a UN-backed, response to any infectious disease of this magnitude.
Yeah, I agree entirely. So this is something we have to look at in coming years.
All right. Professor Diodanan, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, sir. My pleasure.
Okay. Rewat Dionandan, the professor of the Interdisciplinary School of Health Sciences at the University of Ottawa, an epidemiologist and a global health researcher. Great talking to him on a very frightening subject, Ebola.